You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Larry, the legend, Lepard. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Hey, Marty, always good to be with you. I really enjoy talking to you.
I do as well. It's better in person. It was great seeing you in person in Abu Dhabi. It was an interesting conference. It was my first time in the Middle East.
Yeah, absolutely. It's spreading, you know? People are buying it everywhere.
Trump coin.
Oh, boy. Don't get me started.
It's spreading everywhere.
Yeah, you know, you got to take the good with the bad, right? I mean, there are a lot of things that are really great about Trump. And, you know, his ego and all those other things are what drive him to be who he is, which is in many ways great. It comes with some flaws, too.
Yeah, if we're all being honest with ourselves, I know there's a lot of people kvetching about the meme coin. I think it's a terrible idea, obviously. But
me too.
Is there anything more on brand for the Trump family?
No, absolutely. I mean, you almost could have predicted it. I mean, I was around when he created Trump Air. This is a long time ago. He created an airline to compete with the Eastern Shuttle from New York to Boston in the early 80s. So the guy just can't help putting his name on shit.
Yeah. He's going to put his name on buildings, airplanes, boxes of steaks, board games.
Coins, all of it.
Golf clubs, wineries, and now the digital economy, meme coins.
Yeah, golf courses. Yeah, he's got a few of those. Yeah.
Let's put aside the meme coin, though.
The good news is, I mean, think about how much more crypto-friendly and Bitcoin-friendly this administration is. And if it comes with a few things that we have to hold our nose on, well, that's the price we pay, right?
I think it's well worth it. I can't imagine.
Oh, no doubt about it. It's well worth it. I mean, I feel sorry for people who get sucked into that shit and are going to lose their money.
Bitcoiners been arguing for this, like, they're a contingent of Bitcoiners been arguing, just like, when the idea of levying an illegal securities lawsuit against Ethereum would come up, people would just be like, just let it fail, let people touch the stove, learn their lesson, and they'll all be funneled to Bitcoin. At the end of the day, it's all funneled down to Bitcoin.
Well, that's right. We know how this ends. We've seen it.
Yeah. Speaking of ending, the Biden administration ended. I saw you tweeting about this. I forget it was last week or earlier this week. But Janet Yellen left the Trump administration in a pretty shitty spot.
How many people did they pay to have them stand on the steps and applaud her departure, right?
There was way too many.
Those had to be paid actors. I mean, it's really quite a mess. Trump is inheriting a bag of shit. There's a strong argument that says that if he wants to break some glass, he should do it early while he can still, you know, in the economy, while he can still blame Biden, because in a couple of years he's going to own whatever happened.
Yeah, it's not looking good. Reverse repo markets, or the repo markets are draining. Janet Yellen just out of the corner of her mouth on the way out, like, by the way, the Treasury is almost out of money. We're going to hit the debt ceiling.
Yeah,
in a month, commercial real estate delinquency rates going up, and it's weird. It's just this weird juxtaposition of that backdrop, federal government debt far surpassing $37 trillion now, I believe, and the interest expense on that debt surpassing defense spending. You have that backdrop. You have Europe crumbling as well. Which is probably a good thing for the people of Europe, that overbearing communist system needs to break. But you have all that, and then you have the Trump administration coming in. Looks like, as you mentioned, a significantly better environment from a regulatory perspective. It's very clear, at least with the executive orders that have been signed and the people that have been placed in the administration, that economic policy is going to be much better for the next 4 years. At least it seems that way at this point. And people have an incredible amount of optimism The headline of yesterday was the golden era. Across every paper, we're heading into this golden era, but there is this 9,000-pound gorilla in the corner of the room, which is this systemic debt issue.
Yeah, it really is. And I mean, the bull case is that AI is going to save us, and that all these hyperscalers and all the capex they're, you know, spending is keeping the economy going. And you know, perhaps it will. I mean, if it does keep going, it's going to have to be inflationary. That's something I think we know. I mean, I just wrote my quarterly. It's available on my thread on X. And you know, we're seeing the CPI go up month by month. We're seeing a lot of labor pressure. You know, when the longshoremen went out in October, they got a deal that was 60%+ over 6 years. So that's 10% a year wage increases. I mean, that's a long way from 2%. You know, also in my quarterly, there was a great chart from Tavi Costa that showed that agricultural commodities were up 28% last year, that's why the, you know, grocery store hurts so much, right? I mean, you know, so this 2 or 3% CPI that they're aiming for, not even achieving the 2, it's not accurate, and things are much worse than that shows. And so the only way they can keep it going is ultimately to print more. That's the name of the book, you know, The Big Print. I mean, we know it's coming. I mean, they've kind of done it in a subterranean way, in the sense that, you know, Yellen has sucked the money out of the reverse repo and used that to grow M2. But I think eventually it's going to come to a head. And interestingly enough, I mean, I think we're going to see a titanic clash between Powell and Trump. Because we absolutely have to have lower interest rates to lower that interest expense and to roll those bills. I mean, Janet really left Trump with a bag of shit when she termed everything, you know, didn't term out enough debt and tilted toward doing bills. And so we've got all these bills rolling over, and if they're at a rate of, you know, 4% plus, that's, you know, the 1.2 of annual interest expense is going to be a much bigger number. And it's, you know, we all know what the debt doom loop is. It seems like we're looking at it. So it's, my view is kind of like the popcorn. It's just going to be a very interesting year.
Yeah, it's going to be. It already is an interesting year, but I think when you consider, that's what Parker and I have talked about. I just talked about it with Turdemeester, and that's my big question. Like, is there a looming liquidity crisis? Like, you mentioned reverse repo. I've been trying to juice stealth quantitative easing with that, but it seems like that is reaching the limits of which it can be squeezed. And
yeah, it's been drawn down. It's a couple hundred million now. The other thing that has helped in terms of liquidity is it's a global liquidity issue. We all know the money comes from everywhere, and China's been printing like crazy. And so you see M2 starting to go up again. I've got a good chart on that, also in my quarterly report. So, you know, it's a toxic macro setup, and you know, it's going to blow up, I think. But so far, it hasn't.
What's up, freaks? This is Nat. You don't want to skip, because Fold has a great offer for you. Everyone knows about Fold, the app where you can earn the most Bitcoin rewards for everyday purchases. I did this yesterday. Me and my wife, we use Amazon to buy quite a few things. And instead of just putting our credit card into Amazon and buying there, I put my credit card into Fold and buy an Amazon gift card and upload it to Amazon. Why? Because I get the credit card points and then I get sats back. Yesterday, I bought a gift card. I made 10,181 sats, about $10.50 in Bitcoin. And it's the only way to do it. If you want to stack Bitcoin passively, make sure you're using Fold gift cards. Fold has a special deal. I mentioned it earlier. If you're not shopping with Fold gift cards, you're leaving sats on the table. New users that sign up to Fold are going to get 20,000 sats in a welcome bonus with their first gift card purchase. So don't leave sats on the table. Sign up now at foldapp.com/Marty. Get those 20,000 sats, freaks. Sup, freaks. This rip of TFTC was brought to you by our good friends at BitKey. BitKey makes Bitcoin easy to use and hard to lose. It is a hardware wallet that natively embeds into a 2 or 3 multi-sig. You have one key on the hardware wallet, one key on your mobile device, and Block stores a key in the cloud for you. This is an incredible hardware device for your friends and family, or maybe yourself, who have Bitcoin on exchanges and have for a long time, but haven't taken the step to self-custody because they're worried about the complications of setting up a private public key pair, securing that seed phrase, setting up a PIN, setting up a passphrase. Again, BitKey makes it easy to use, hard to lose. It's the easiest 0-to-1 step, your first step to self-custody. If you have friends and family on the exchanges who haven't moved it off, tell them to pick up a BitKey. Go to bitkey.world, use the key TFTC20 at checkout for 20% off your order. That's bitkey.world, code TFTC20. Yeah, there's a lot to get through, but inevitably when things do blow up, because I think mathematically the hens are going to come home to roost at some point, and actions are going to need to be taken. The next big print, which gets to your book, and I think it's a good time. Hopefully people, there is enough time between now and when that is inevitably going to come to fruition. And between now and then, once the book launches, we were talking within the next few weeks, hopefully people can get their hands on it and really understand the problem. Because as I mentioned, we were in Abu Dhabi. I've got an early copy of the book in PDF form. And your intent with this book was to basically explain how everybody's fucking us. ultimately, continuously, over and over again, which leads to more printing and why.
My wife doesn't let me use that word, but that's about right. Like, there have been some great books written, and I borrowed heavily in this book. I mean, this is a safe-hitting book and a Lynn book. But what I found in handing out the Bitcoin Standard, I often found people would get it, they'd start into it, it'd be heavy, and they wouldn't read it. And so what I tried to do was kind of tell a story and make a more easily understandable narrative that anyone could relate to. You don't have to be a financial type. I mean, as an example, early on, I had some people read it who have no financial background, and one guy said, "What's the Federal Reserve?" And so, okay, so I get a footnote explaining what the Federal Reserve is.
No, trying to illuminate your, I think the last part before we pause to fix the technical difficulties, saying, you've learned, people have read the book, don't know about the Federal Reserve, and haven't really experienced tumultuous times in the market, whether it's 2008, LTCM, going back to the 70s, 80s. And
yeah, that's right. I mean, it's, again, the money problem is a sophisticated problem that if you're just an average American, you don't think about it very much, except you know your prices are going up. And the inflation, you experience that, front and center. And then you've got a bunch of politicians on the left who are all saying it's the greedy corporations that are the problem, when it's really not the greedy corporations, it's the Federal Reserve. And more importantly, it's the way the system is structured. I mean, the system is structured, as you said earlier, to require inflation. It's just math. Without inflation, we've got, debt. Our money system is based on debt. And so without a growing base of debt, you can't service the debt. So it's going to continually grow, and it's, that growth has started to compound. And anybody who plays around with compound numbers knows that they eventually go parabolic. And we're kind of in that stage now. As Parker would say, we're in the suddenly phase.
You think we're in suddenly?
Yeah, I think we are. I mean, it feels to me like we are. My most recent quarterly had two charts that show, the value. I mean, the 10-year bond used to be the base layer of collateral in the world. Everyone, it was the securest thing in the world, and everyone relied upon it as a mechanism for pricing everything else. And in 10-year bond terms, gold since 2020, which is when the last big print really started, gold's up 200%, and Bitcoin's up 2,000%. And so to me, these are both clear signs that we are in a sovereign debt crisis, full stop. And those kinds of things don't get easily solved. And Powell thought he could do a Volcker and just raise rates and calm down the inflation, everything would be fine. But he's wrong, because when Volcker did that, debt to GDP was 30 some odd percent. Now it's 120. So he made the problem worse inadvertently. Caused Silicon Valley Bank to fail, and you know, it's gonna just continue until we blow up again. And at that point in time, they will have to print more money. And eventually, I think we will either have extremely high inflation leading to some good political leadership and a monetary reset, or we'll have extremely high inflation leading to hyperinflation and the complete failure of the currency. And it's unclear which. It depends upon politics a lot. But I think one of those two cases is going to happen in the next several years and then become acute before what I kind of consider two. I think this whole thing's going to get solved by 2030. That's 6 years away, but we're in it, and it's a fourth turning, and they typically take about that amount of time. So my view is we're gonna see this end game play out pretty quickly. And the book is divided into two sections. The first part is the problem, how you're getting screwed, how they're screwing you, why they're screwing you, how the system is broken for the average American and really average world citizen. And then the second part of the book is the solution, which most people watching this podcast probably know it, but for those who don't, it's Bitcoin, from the base layer on up. And so I educate people as to what Bitcoin is, and I try to dispel, the rumors and concerns. I mean, there's some really, I think my wife made a very meaningful contribution. She doesn't know anything about monetary policy. She's a writer and artist and was an ad executive when she was working. And she read it and she had a lot of comments like, they're not going to understand this, and why don't you clarify this? Why don't you clarify that? But she came up with one really great suggestion. She said, why don't you write a chapter and call it skepticism and just talk about how, all throughout history, whenever something new has come along, there's been skepticism, whether it's the Luddites or the Red Flag Act or, Krugman with the fax machine or, there are 20 examples. I mean, people saying that, nobody would ever need a personal computer, et cetera, et cetera. And so I did that. And then I also did a lot of debunking of the difference between Bitcoin and crypto because, frankly, as we all know, Sam Bankman-Fried really did us a disservice. And the whole crypto industry, frankly, a lot of it, almost all of it, has done Bitcoin an enormous disservice because Bitcoin really is not crypto. It's a technological revolution. And crypto is a bunch of fraud in most cases. So, I've tried to separate those two. And then there's at the back of the book, there's even a section called, objections and answers. I mean, the kind of thing you would do at the end of a case study where, well, this thing uses too much energy. No, here's a page that explains why it doesn't, or whatever. Just, to, the standard objections are, we can't have deflation. It would mean the Great Depression. No, deflation is what we want. Deflation is a good thing. So I've just tried to attack it from every single possible angle and get the average human to see that this is obvious and it's an incredible opportunity. One thing I kind of arrived at this in writing the book on my own that I thought was a big insight was just the nature of Metcalfe's law and the nature of value creation in network businesses. And so I point out that when, the internet really changed the world in a big way. It was the first big, the microprocessor was a big revolution, PCs, fine, but it all led to the internet, which was the first revolution pre the Bitcoin revolution, which is the next one. And one of the things that's very interesting is that in the internet, there are businesses in the internet that in a 20-year time frame, from the time the internet really kind of became commercial around 2000 till present, 24-year time frame, have gone up by, Amazon, 218,000%. Google 9,000%, Facebook 3,000%, Microsoft 4,000%, there are network businesses that have increased thousands and thousands of percent from the day when they were introduced. And pre the internet, that just didn't happen. I mean, if you study, General Motors from 1915 to 1960, it didn't go up thousands of percent. It went up a lot in value, but not the kind, and by the way, that was over a 50-year period. Network, and by the way, it's also why I miss those businesses. I mean, I remember looking at Amazon and Facebook as possible investments back in the early days, and I looked at the multiples, and I was like, I can't pay that much for this. It just makes no sense. Because I was trained in the old, you got to look at the PE, and you got to look at the cash flows, and I didn't understand the way that networks grow in value, as a square of the underlying number of users. I mean, basically Metcalfe's law. And that's a very powerful, different model for looking at investments. And it's why, you know, you have to hold your nose and pay what you think is too much when you're investing in a network business, because if the network continues to grow, pretty soon it's not going to be too much anymore. You know, and I think one of the biggest things I'm encountering right now in trying to get wealthy friends to buy Bitcoin is they all know I have a much lower basis and I've been buying it for a bunch of years. And like, well, how can I pay $100,000 for stuff you were buying at $400,000, you know, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000? You know, I'm getting robbed. And I'm like, no, you know, did the people who were buying Microsoft in 1991 get robbed? You know, I mean, because if it truly is Saylor's model that it's going up forever, Laura, you know, it doesn't matter where you buy it. You just got to buy it, right?
Yeah.
And so to me, I we've got to get that across to the average American, because that price bias is really large in my experience.
Yeah. And building on the network business example that you just gave too, whether it's Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, Google, pick your litter of the FANG stocks. Like, that network business is somewhat limited too. Like, they each, like Google with Android, yeah, and Apple, they compete against each other. Amazon and Walmart compete against each other.
No, it's kind of a winner take all generally. I mean, it's, yeah, you want to be in the leading one, which is why, and Bitcoin's clearly the leading monetary solution by, you know, miles, orders of magnitude. So, you know, to me, it's so incredibly obvious what's going to happen here.
Yeah. And it's got a much bigger addressable market as well.
Absolutely. I mean, this isn't just, you know, selling books and then, you know, Walmart like stuff. I mean, this is money. This is every single part of human interaction, because there's very little that happens in this world without money being involved. So, yeah, it I mean, and it goes to, and I've got, you know, I mean, there's so many great, I mean, you know, your stuff, Marty. I mean, so many people that I've drawn on in pulling this book together. I mean, I didn't write this book. I crowdsourced this book and put it in order to make it simple for a normie to understand, right? And, you know, like, I've got Jesse Meyer's chart in there that shows the $900 trillion of assets. And here we are with Bitcoin at $2 trillion. Bitcoin is 2/10 of all the financial assets in the world. 2/10, right? I mean, it's of all the assets in the world. I mean, Bitcoin could go up 10x, i.e. we could be at $1 million a coin. It'd be 2%. It's still trivial. I mean, art and cars and, you know, gold are more than that. So it really, it's just got so much headroom above it right now. And so many people think they're too late, and they're not. I mean, it's obviously they are late compared to, you know, Max. I mean, you know, and don't we all wish we were back there buying it? I mean, I bought some at 300 or 400. God, I wish I'd bought 10 times as much, but I didn't have the vision to do it. And, you know, I thought it was going to fail. I wasn't sure. To me, it was an experiment in 2013 or 14, you know. Now it's no longer an experiment. It's a movement, you know.
So. And that's the point I was just going to make. Like, you can easily make the argument, yes, the price tag that you see on a per Bitcoin basis is obviously right below all-time highs, so it seems like the most expensive ever. But to your point there, many people thought it was, and many people, I think, it would accurately describe it as an experiment back then. And so from a risk-adjusted perspective today...
Well, that's exactly right. The risk is significantly lower. I mean, I remember talking to people about it, and I frankly was concerned about it, that the government was going to outlaw it, ban it, tax it, attack it, etc. And then the ETF got approved, and, you know, suddenly that was no longer such a big issue. So, you know, it's clearly starting to, you know, go mainstream, as we all can see. And, you know, Saylor talks about, we're in the, you know, really in the 10-year kind of gold rush period, where it's going to, I think, just explode into everybody's consciousness. I mean, when it gets to 200 and 300 and 400, you know, people are going to be more, hang on a second, what is going on here?
Yeah.
You know, this isn't a bubble. I mean, this is a movement. And if that's matched with the price of everything else is going up really rapidly, then we could end up seeing, you know, a large scale adaptation of Gresham's law, where, you know, people realize, oh my God, I got to get out of this burning fiat money and into something sound.
This rip was brought to you by our great friends at Unchained. As Bitcoin's role in the global financial landscape evolves, understanding its potential impact on your wealth becomes increasingly crucial. Whether we see measured adoption or accelerated hyper-Bitcoinization, being prepared for various scenarios can make the difference between merely participating and truly optimizing your position. This is important, freaks. This is why Unchained developed the Bitcoin Calculator, a sophisticated modeling tool that helps you visualize and prepare for multiple Bitcoin futures. Beyond traditional retirement planning, it offers deep insights into how different adoption scenarios could transform your wealth trajectory. What sets this tool apart is the integration with the Unchained IRA, the only solution that combines the tax advantages of a retirement account with the security of self-custody. In any future state, maintaining direct control of your keys remains fundamental to your Bitcoin strategy. Go explore the potential futures at unchained.com/TFTC. Bitcoin is going up. Make sure you're protecting it the right way. Make sure you have a good partner. That is Unchained. Go to unchained.com/TFTC.
I've got a couple of thoughts here. The first is I gave a Bitcoin 101 presentation to a high school class a couple of months ago, and
nice.
Had that one question brought up to me. It seems very expensive now. It was like $95,000 when we did the presentation. I was like, yeah, it may look that way. And like, it's too late for me to adopt it. And it's like, no, it's literally a better technology. It's a better monetary good. Like, is it too late to adopt fire, the wheel, the combustion engine?
Exactly. Like,
no, you're always going to want to use the best technology.
I have a funny story on that. Yeah.
What's that?
Yeah. Well, so I'm down at the New Orleans Investment Conference, and I'm talking to James Grant. Do you know who he is? He writes Grant's Interesting.
Bow tie.
I have enormous respect for this guy. I mean, he's been a hard money gold guy, sound money guy for 40 years, written all kinds of great books, and just incredibly solid. And I said to him, Jim, this is really something you got to open your eyes to and focus on, because it's meeting Menger's definition of money. I mean, people are accepting it. It's trading. It's got real volume, et cetera, and this, that, and the other. And he looked at me and said, yeah, Larry, he said, when it's been around 1,000 years, then maybe I'll start to have a serious look at it. And my response to him was, Jim, are you going to wait 1,000 years until you accept airplane flight? I mean, it's a fucking technical innovation, right? I mean, why does it need 1,000 years of history to prove itself? It's already proven itself. It's got 16 years of very solid history with no problems. I mean, to me, that's conclusive. And but some people just don't see it, or they're wedded to the old way, that gold is the only sound money in the world, and it's not, and it's significantly flawed compared to Bitcoin. And I say that, as I was a gold guy before Bitcoin existed. I was as hardcore a gold guy as there is.
Yeah, just steel manning Jim's argument too. It's like, well, did the first people use gold as money wait 1,000 years to use it as money, or did they just recognize?
Exactly. I mean, it's like you said, like fire. Well, not all, what, this hasn't been around long enough. We don't really believe in this. Let's stop doing this. Let's just eat these animals raw.
Yeah. There's something weird about the mental blockers that people put on to avoid seeing the obvious innovation and superiority of Bitcoin.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is. It's strange. I mean, I get it with the fiat people. I mean, to them, they're not feeling any pain and they like the system the way it is because it benefits them. I get that. I mean, those are the bankers and others. I see a lot of the time, but the gold guys, many of them have made the jump the way I have, but not all of them, obviously. And a lot of them are really locked in the past and just can't see it. Accept it. It's a shame because they've got the monetary piece right, and they predicted it right for a long time, and it's happening, but they haven't made the switch. I mean, I sat next to Peter Schiff on a panel down in New Orleans as well, and I see pain in the guy's eyes because I think he knew he could have bought. I mean, he could have bought it $1 or $2. I mean, Max was pumping him on, and he knew what it was. He was very early on aware of it, and he just kind of came to the conclusion, no, this isn't going to work. And that's that. And now I think he's just so, I think his ego just won't let him go back and say, I made a mistake. I mean, hell, Saylor in 2013 said it wasn't going to work, right? And he reevaluated it. I think he read Safe's book and it caused him to change his mind. And, and there's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with not understanding something new when it comes out. That's fine. But not taking the time to continue to learn and then dig in and maybe revise your views as you get additional evidence. I mean, I know when it came out, my great fear was that it was going to fail like all the other efforts. I mean, I saw eCash fail. I saw DigiCash fail. I saw B-Money fail. And so when I first saw it, I mean, the reason I wasn't buying it at $1 or $2, I was like, yeah, I've seen this shit. It doesn't work. They all failed. And of course, I didn't know what the difficulty adjustment was. I didn't know anything about the technology or hashing or any of that shit. But I just said, oh, yeah, you know, mental heuristic, great, yeah. Money based on the internet, yep, been tried, doesn't work, done. You know, and then, but then, you know, then it went from $1 to $100, and then it went from $100 to $1,000. I was like, uh-oh, you know, Larry, I think you might have blown the call here. Right. Well, and I did. I blew the call.
You know? You didn't blow it. It just took you a couple cycles.
It took some time. Well, I did. I mean, God damn it. I wish I bought it at $1 like Max.
I did too. I think that's the unfortunate thing is that people are going to be forced into Bitcoin due to the scenario, which you described earlier, which is like the two paths that the Fed and the Treasury have right now. Is like, do you completely debase or do you reset? And on that note, have you been following anything that Scott Bessent's been saying over the last year?
Yeah, I sure have. I've looked at that really carefully, and my partner David Foley and I are all over that. And we know some people who know him, so we've got a real sense of where his head is at. I mean, first of all, consider a couple of facts that maybe some of your audience don't know. One, he's a gold guy. He believes in gold, which means he understands sound money. He said gold was one of his largest holdings. He's been impressed by how much gold the central banks have been buying, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a fact. And I also know he likes Bitcoin, but that's kind of, he hasn't said that publicly or stated as much. The second thing he said somewhere in one of the pods that I listened to in the last couple of years was something along the lines of, you know, the monetary situation is troublesome and we may need to do some kind of a reset, you know, and he compared it to like a Bretton Woods reset. And he said, and if that happens, I want to be at the table. So I was like, whoa, I mean, this is not Janet Yellen, right? This is somebody who, you know, I think may understand Triffin's dilemma and the issue we're all very much aware of. And so I think that's a big positive. You know, he is trying with this 333 plan to, you know, thread the needle of getting us from here to there. I think that he and Trump and, you know, Musk and Ramaswamy, or it used to be Ramaswamy, I guess he's dropped out of Doge, you know, are perhaps, in my opinion, being a little naive or a little unaware of just how deep the problem is, and how large the problem is. I mean, and one of the things I wrote about this in our quarterly too, is that, you know, we got a big bump in the market and we got a big, you know, sigh of relief that Trump is coming in, and therefore maybe he's going to be able to, you know, and Doge is going to help, and they're going to cut the budget and balance the budget, and the monetary issues that everyone says we face, they're all going to go away. It's all going to be good. And, you know, that's Elon, you know, talking about self-driving in 2018 when it's not really ready yet, because Doge just can't do what they say they're going to do. They can, at the margin, they can help. And I'm all for cutting government access and expense and balancing the budget. I'm all for all of that. But if you look at the math, unless we decide we want to cut, you know, Medicare, Social Security, defense budget, you know, by 50%, you know, it can't happen. That's where all the money is. And so, you know, it's this monetary train that Lynn Alden, you know, in fact, I got a chapter in the book and I got her approval to put it in there called Nothing Stops This Train. You know, this train is just bearing down on us. And it's, as you said earlier in the podcast, it's math. It's just math. And so that's why, you know, I have such a high level of confidence that we're right. And that, you know, that we are going to have a monetary, you know, event here that's going to have to lead us towards a sounder monetary system, because the one we've got is wrong and broken.
Yeah, and going back to your comments about the Trump admin potentially having to fight the Fed and Jerome Powell, I mean, that's another thing. As he keeps rates higher, and I don't know where the 10-year is today or the 30-year is, but, you know, they've been elevated and moving inversely with the Fed cuts, which is a historical anomaly.
Absolutely.
And we've got a lot of debt to roll over this year. So I'm sure Bessent is like, we got to do something to fix the long end of the
curve. Yeah, I mean, I've got the one and the 2 year at 4.2 and 4.3. You know, the 10 year is at 4.6 and the 30 year is at 4.8. I mean, and I think the average interest rate on all the federal debt right now is in the threes, low to mid threes. And, you know, if that continues, I mean, I think we're rolling $6 trillion of bills. I think I've got that right. I could be wrong. This year, and at these interest rates, federal interest expense is going to increase, and that's going to make the deficit worse. So, they really need to. I mean, as Luke Grohman does such a nice job of pointing out, they really need to get interest rates down and let inflation take place, you know, which is sad because it hurts all of us. But without that, the whole thing is going to implode. Yeah. Because the interest expense is just going to continue to consume the budget.
Which is, I mean, if Jerome doesn't play ball, and I've listened to the fireside chats and podcasts where Secretary Bessent has discussed the idea of Bretton Woods 2.0, like maybe just convinces Trump, like, this is what we got to do, get everybody to the table. And I just wonder, in 2025, what does that look like?
Yeah, very, very, very hard to know. I mean, if you did a Bitcoin strategic reserve, I mean, you know, Trump said something also that I thought was very interesting. He said Bitcoin is the new oil. I mean, you know, they had an inflationary problem in the 70s, and part of what, you know, part of the way they did dealt with it all was, you know, the petrodollar, and they had a deficit problem, and the Triffitt's dilemma, I guess, was biting in the 70s, and what they did is they revalued oil up greatly, you know, with the Arab oil embargo, and apparently Kissinger was involved in part of that process. And, you know, I mean, if you've got too much debt in nominal terms today and you've got to devalue it, what do you devalue it against? You've got to devalue it against something that's neutral and that's got a more limited supply. Historically, that would have been gold, but, you know, we're beyond that now. And the natural thing is Bitcoin. And so, you know, I think one of the things they're going to be facing if they do an SBR, and as you and I both talked about in MENA, you know, Matthew Pine says he thinks they are going to do an SBR, and I think they are too. The question then becomes, how big is it? How aggressively do they do it? How much does that push the price of Bitcoin? And does, you know, Bitcoin become the natural choice for some kind of a monetary reset? And I think the answer is all of those things are possible, but how we get from here to there is anybody's guess.
Yeah.
All I know, though, is I feel very good owning Bitcoin and a little bit of gold, you know?
Yeah. No, I think it would have to play a part. And yeah, the strategic reserve, I mean, that's, I mean, Luke's talked about this. Like, how do you, because that's the catch-22. Maybe it's not a catch-22, but it's a very hard problem, rock and a hard place, probably better to describe. Really, can they get out of it? Like, because if you signal, we're accumulating a million Bitcoin, it's like, all right, everybody dumps treasuries. And
well, that's right. And the dollar slides. And I mean, but it is a way to devalue the dollar, and we need to devalue the dollar. The other thing that's beautiful about it is that, in the Jason Lowry sense, is that it, you know, I mean, China and India and a lot of the Middle East, other countries, they've all made their bet on gold. And, you know, if we make our bet on Bitcoin, you know, we neatly leapfrog them in terms of, you know, being on a monetary standard that's sounder and more likely to win in the long term. So I think they'll do it. I mean, that's my take. They're going to do it. But, you know, how and when, I mean, it's anybody's guess. You know, one of the things I said earlier, though, is, I mean, in my opinion, whatever Trump's going to do, I think he's got to do it relatively quickly, because he's got a year or two at the most of grace before any economic problems become Trump problems. I think if anything happens in the next 6 months, he can say, hey, Biden did this. You know, I inherited a bag of shit. Biden did it.
Yeah.
But after that period of time, I think he's going to, you know, it's going to stick to him. And so if they're going to break some glass, my opinion is they've got to do it quickly. And I think they're smart enough to know that, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, not only from the perspective of being able to levy the blame on the Biden administration and the mess that they left, but also just from the Bitcoin adoption incentives on that level. Like, I have it on good authority. I've talked to people behind the scenes looking to get intros, because there are other governments who saw the campaign promises made by Trump, and particularly around Bitcoin, and said, all right, we got to move, and behind the scenes are looking
at it. I think there's a lot of that going on. I mean, we've all heard, you know, various rumors and things, some of the stuff we're not allowed really to even talk about, but I think there are a lot of governments. I mean, this is all, you know, nation state FOMO is right around the corner, kind of the way I see it, based on what's going on.
Yeah, and from the perspective of Trump, too, like, this would be an extremely savvy move, not only for I mean, this is how you would manufacture a soft landing for the American economy, not only at the federal level, but I think one thing I hope that he and the people that are surrounding him understand is that Americans, on a per capita basis, own the most Bitcoin. And so you're going to have this massive wealth effect of the individual Bitcoin holders in the United States. And if you're worried about any collateral damage from that, like, I think you have to factor in that Bitcoiner, that American Bitcoiner wealth effect into the equation, and they can help recapitalize the economy and get things back on the ground, back on their feet rather quickly.
It's a very good point. I mean, it's a very good point. I mean, but let me just say that almost no matter what happens, I don't see how we do any kind of a reset without there being a pretty big one-time inflationary event. As I argue in the book, much better to, you know, do it once, have it hurt, get it right, and then be on sound money. Because history shows that when you return to sound money, economies function pretty well. But to get from here to sound money, somebody's going to have to lose.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of assets out there that are misvalued, most particularly bonds. and they're going to get marked to market, and the bondholders aren't going to like it.
No.
You know, and that's going to be inflationary. So, you know, there's no way out of this trap without some pain. But frankly, if we keep going in this direction in the slow walk thing, we're just going to have continued inflation, and it's going to go from 2 or 3% like the 70s back up into double digits. And, you know, I mean, I think what's going to ultimately happen, Marty, is people are going to be screaming about inflation so loudly that this monetary reset's going to get forced on the politicians in the world, you know, that people are just going to say, you know, no mas, we just can't take it anymore. You got to fix this. And the Volcker approach isn't going to work. We can't just fix it with high interest rates. You really almost have to do a debt jubilee. The book talks about that.
Yeah. No, I mean, and that's, I think maybe the catch 22 is like what you just described. If the bonds particularly get marked to market, like that's the unfortunate consequence of the post 2008 reserve ratio regulations have been thrust. Like most of these banks just holding treasuries as their liquid reserves.
Right. Well, and it's going to hurt, you know, it's going to hurt seniors. It's going to hurt the boomers. I mean, the boomers will probably get paid everything they're owed. I mean, because nobody's willing to restructure Social Security and, you know, means test it and increase the age and do a lot of things to fix the medical system, you know, okay, fine. So boomers are going to get paid all that money that they were owed. But the problem is it's just not going to buy anything close to what they thought it was going to buy, because the price level is going to be 2 or 3x where it is today. You know, and that's, I mean, there's, you know, you can manufacture a short-term so-called free lunch, but eventually you got to sit down to a banquet of consequences, and that's common.
Yeah. Yeah. It'll sound scary to a lot of people. It'll be like doom and gloomers, but that was actually the one thing I took, one of the like things I remember very acutely from our conversation in Abu Dhabi at dinner that one night, is how quickly you believe the economy can recover if you allow these things to happen.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's the good news. That's the really good news. I mean, I've studied a lot of hyperinflations, and it's amazing. I mean, human beings want to get up every morning and do useful stuff and take care of their family and work hard and make money and have a fair system. And so, you know, there've been countries that have been ravaged by hyperinflation. They go back to, you know, sound money standard, boom, and the economy just recovers and heals. It's like amazing, you know, but let's not forget the ravaging does occur. I mean, a good example of that, Ecuador, I think it was in 2000, had a massive hyperinflation, and just money is worthless. And then, you know, what they did is they actually dollarized. They just went on to a dollar standard. And, you know, on a relative basis, the dollar was so sound compared to their existing currency. And yeah, economy is thriving, booming, you know, very quickly right afterwards. So, and this has happened in other places as well. So now the people get scarred. I mean, in the 20s, the 23 German example, you know, the people were so scarred by it that that's what led to the rise of Hitler. So, you know, I mean, there are winners and losers in these monetary events. And you just can't help that. I mean, if you wanted to prevent that, you should have prevented the system from getting as broken as it's gotten broken. I mean, the book walks you through every single step they took. I mean, they got rid of Glass-Steagall. They modernized, you know, commodities futures. They, you know, I mean, it's just one thing after another. I love that line. History is just, it's like Roseanne, Rosanna, Dan. History is just one damn thing after another. They just kept making it worse.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, and it, like you said, things are extremely mispriced right now. You have you have liquidity flowing into areas of the economy that arguably you shouldn't be in and is there for the wrong reasons. And I think as a millennial, like housing is one that sticks out to me. Right. And as a young man with family and a growing family that would like to move into like a very comfortable forever house, like I wouldn't mind a little repricing of the real estate market.
Absolutely. No, too much wealth has been stored there. And yeah, no, it's, yeah, there are all kinds of things that are just completely mispriced right now. I mean, I see it. I mean, you know, yeah, it's bad. Yeah.
And I think too, if you had an Ecuador event like you described, God forbid with the dollar, but potentially with the dollar, with how things are going, like I think Bitcoin, maybe not self-custody Bitcoin, using Lightning and stuff like that, but I think the infrastructure of the industry is such that it could help facilitate a somewhat smooth transition to a Bitcoin economy.
I agree. I mean, I like to think that this isn't ugly, you know, that the mandibles is not the way this plays out. You know, that we're all smarter and better educated than to let it go down that path. You know, it could be better than I'm hoping for, and I hope it is. I really do. I do know though that there are going to be a lot of assets. You know, what has worked for the last 40 years is not going to work in the next 10 or 20. You know, and what's going to work in the next 10 or 20 is just different. I mean, and I think people are going to be kind of blown away. You know, this to me is very much like the turning point that occurred when Volcker raised rates in 1979 and 80 and put us on a deflationary path. I mean, the long bond at one point traded at 15%. There was a guy named Gary Schilling who got wealthy by buying long bond zeros, you know, which means he bought the zero coupons way out, and he made a 10-bagger in 5 years, you know. So just because he could see that deflation was coming. And I remember it very clearly. I remember I started in business in 82 and 3, and everybody and the brother thought, you know, we'll never solve inflation. It's here forever. It's absolutely, inflation is the problem of our lifetime. And of course, that was just the point at which it started to come down. And it came down consistently for 40 years. And, you know, as you recall, before all this broke out, the Federal Reserve was saying, hey, we're winning in every single respect, except we're not hitting our inflation target. We've got no, you know, inflation's too low. We need 2%. We need animal spirits. Of course, and when they printed 42% of the money in 2 years, they were able to actually generate some inflation. And the amazing thing is that, you know, that Jerome Powell, who wasn't an economist, you know, couldn't foresee that that was what was going to occur. The even more amazing thing is that Janet Yellen, who is a PhD economist, said it was transitory and didn't see what was going to occur. I mean, that, you know, it is like we're being run by, you know, people, you know, the country's just being run by people who are incompetent. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Well, not only that, but the being run by people who are incompetent, like Janet Yellen from the Fed to the Treasury. Jerome Powell's been in his place for a while. And so those two particularly have overseen a lot of the monetary abuse that has been levied on the populace over the last 15 years. And, I think that's the other, to talk about the big prints, and you have 08 and you have European credit crisis, and you have 2020, really 2019 with the repo spasm, and you have 2023 with the banking crisis, and each thing led to a big print. And it seems like the time between each event is becoming more and more compressed. So here we are in 2025. 2 years from post 2023, I would not be surprised if something materializes from liquidity perspective.
The magnitude gets larger too. I mean, it took you know, Bernanke, you know, 3 or 4 years to grow the Fed balance sheet from 900 to 3 or 4 trillion. I mean, it took Powell 18 months to go from 4 trillion high threes to nine. You know, so he printed $6 trillion in 18 months. I mean, the next one, that's why I call it the big print. The next one's not going to be, you know, it's going to take more. Every one of these interventions takes more and gets larger. And that's why, you know, the system is slowly but surely, in my opinion, spinning out of control. you know, and that's unfortunate, but it is what it is. It's just the math of compounding.
Maybe the aliens will come and solve this problem for us.
There we go. Yeah, we'll get it. Deus Ex Machina. We're going to get solved. You know, we're going to create a credit bubble at some higher level. Yeah, I don't think so.
We need to.
I mean, I talk about this in the book. I mean, I really blew it. I thought 2008 was it. I thought the whole system, ZERP and QE. I thought, okay, this is it. We're going into hyperinflation. But I was totally wrong. I mean, they were able to sterilize it and kick it up to the next level. You know, that was a credit crisis driven by a housing bubble. And they kicked it up into what we now all call the everything bubble, you know, and the next level, it's the sovereign credit that's at risk and the money's that's at risk. And there's no level above this. I mean, if the sovereign credit goes bad and the money goes bad, you know, the next level is we return to sound money, full stop.
Yeah.
So that's coming. But, you know, the path from here to there, it's going to be a tortured one. And I think we all have to be prepared to, you know, deal with some serious volatility. I'm sure you've seen Dan Oliver's great chart, the Myrmecon chart, of how volatile the Deutschmark was in gold terms as that currency failed. You know, I mean, gold was the right thing to hold, obviously, in a currency failure event. But there were months when it went up 40%, and there were other months when it went down. And so, you know, there's a lot of volatility. And that could happen here. I mean, I remember holding Bitcoin in 2020 when March came around and it got hammered, you know, down quite a bit. And, you know, as we all know, we've had some very big drawdowns. And so, you know, when Powell started, doing rates in 2022 and we discovered that Sam Bankman-Fried was a fraud and that most crypto was a fraud, we went from 67 to 15. By the way, that $15,000 point in that, you know, the year after that was a 22 or something. What an amazing buying opportunity. I mean, you're buying that then for what I paid in Thanksgiving of 2017.
You know? Yeah.
I mean, and you had, I mean, you had 5 years of history and you were able to enter back in at a time at a price below what I paid in 2017. It's like, wow.
Maybe there'll be another opportunity because again, the liquidity.
Well, that's my point. That's the point I'm trying to make. I mean, everyone buying now, I mean, you know, you got to have strong hands here. I mean, I personally think this cycle goes to, you know, the 200-300. And then I think I don't think the dips are going to be as big as they were in the past. I don't think we're going to have any more 70, 80, 90% dips. But a 50% dip is very doable in any volatile asset. I mean, this happened in Amazon. Again, I laid it out in the book. And so, you know, if we squirt on up to 250, could it correct back to 125? Absolutely. You know, and that person who finally capitulated at 250, watching it go down 50%, like, oh shit, I blew it, and blow out their holdings, which would be a huge mistake. But that's the nature of these things. I mean, you know, adopting a new currency, and we're trying to put the ocean into a swimming pool. And, you know, guess what? The swimming pool is going to overflow at times. It's going to be empty, and it's going to be a mess.
Yeah. No, and this could happen on the way up, too. You can imagine a 2023.
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, Samson might be right. Maybe we go to a million on this cycle. I mean, I'd be curious to know. I mean, what's your best guess as to this cycle top?
Okay, I'll tell you how I've been thinking about it.
Yeah.
If the SBR is real.
Right. I think it is.
I think it is, too. If MicroStrategy continues to do what they do, not in the sense of accumulating Bitcoin, but inspiring other corporations to add Bitcoin as a treasury asset. And if the buy, borrow, die mantra really becomes internalized with a lot of Bitcoiners, if better lending products, a better cost of capital come to market, this cycle, which I'm hearing is very likely this year, and even the big four banks are SAB 121.
Yep.
Gets revoked today. I wouldn't be surprised if they begin taking Bitcoin as collateral to issue loans. Like, that's a lot of supply that could stay off the market because of access to credit products or new demand actors who are going to buy and hold for decades. And so I think the combination of those three things, and particularly if the retail Bitcoin investor becomes privy to the buy, borrow, die, and they're able to successfully leverage that strategy without taking on too much risk or leverage, it's hard to see why people would sell Bitcoin at that point where the float is and with all these different actors vying for the most scarce asset in the world. Things could get weird. So high six figures, maybe even touch seven figures. I would not be surprised.
Boy, I hope you're right. I mean, that'd be a lot of fun. But I kind of tend to, think it's 200 to 300. I'm very highly confident we get there. I'm sure we get to 200. I'm pretty sure we get to 300. Beyond that, it's all gravy in my way of seeing it. I mean, one of the things I use is the Meyer multiple, just kind of the, you know, the price compared to the 200-day moving average. And it would be quite a spike to be up around, you know, $1 million a coin. It could be. But I think at that level, you'd actually see some coins, you'd see some supply emerging. I know some of my supply would emerge, and so we'll just have to see. But I agree with you. I mean, there is a lot of demand out there, and we just don't know. I mean, I've always used the power law model as kind of my lower side base case. And then I've always assumed that at some point, if a mass Gresham's law event takes place, that model's going to break. To the upside and not come back down, you know, and maybe we go to a million. I mean, if we truly have outright currency failure, I mean, it's going to go to infinity, you know, in dollar terms. I don't think we're ready for currency failure yet. I don't think enough people are aware of it, of the issue and the problem. But we're on the road, we're definitely on the road towards currency failure.
Yeah, it's insights. But as we said, we've been saying this for a long time. Who knows how long?
Well, we have, and it's taken a lot longer. You know, there've been, there's a lot. You know, there's a lot of institutional momentum in trust in the dollar.
That's a good point to bring up. Institutional momentum, not only in trust in the dollar, but for the Bitcoin case, like you had Ray Dalio come out yesterday. I hold Bitcoin.
He gets it.
You know, Larry Fink. Like saying, I'm talking to sovereign wealth funds. They're deciding, is it 2%? Is it 5%? Like, and I tweeted out this morning, wait long enough by the river and your enemies will start pumping your bags for you.
really is true. Yeah. I always kind of sensed Dalio would get it because Dalio had been a gold guy. He'd been a sound money guy. I think he just didn't understand the technology. Yeah, I mean, look, guys like Paul Tudor Jones, they got it instantly. I mean, he says it's the fastest horse. I think Druckenmiller gets it, but doesn't. He kind of admits that he's just not up on the technology, and so he's not comfortable being in it. I think, although I bet he holds a little bit of it. Look, everybody gets there eventually. I mean, I remember talking to Max years and years ago, and I was kind of there, but not all the way there. I still believed in gold. And he said, you know, gosh, it sounds like you're kind of orange-pilled, but not all the way. And I said, that's about right. I mean, I get it, but it's a little bit of a show me. And I think everybody's Bitcoin journey. I mean, some people are different. Some people just get it totally and go 100% right away. I think most people have been in the investment business for a while. It takes them a while to fully kind of grok it and go down the curve, get all their objections answered, and then maybe live through a few cycles and see that, hey, you know what, this is kind of working, and you know what, I'm hard pressed to figure out what stops it. I mean, when people say this is going to blow up or it's a Ponzi, I say, why? You know, show me the case and explain to me why. I mean, the only ways it fails, in my view, are massive technical failure. I think we're beyond that statistically in terms of the number of blocks and time it's run. The other is if everybody loses interest. You know, if suddenly, I mean, this, I've often said, I mean, money really is a collective illusion. I mean, money is just what we all agree to be money. That was Menger's great point. You know, Carl Menger, the founder of Austrian School of Economics. And so, you know, if suddenly we all just say, you know what, this stuff's just not so great, I don't care about it anymore, let's, you know, something else is better, let's go somewhere, well, that would be an issue. But that's not really what we've seen happen. You know, the adoption, wallets, hash, I mean, whatever metric you want to use, they're all growing solidly, continually, you know, use cases, etc. So I don't perceive there to be that much risk of this not happening. I think there are a lot of different paths, though. I mean, the speed at which it happens, that's, to me, that's a very uncertain thing. I mean, we could, you know, it could take a long time to get to a million, or we could be at a million in a year. I just don't know.
Yeah.
And by long time, I mean 5 years. I think within a 5-year window, these are $1 million a coin easily.
Easily, I agree. I just wonder, because we'll wrap on this, but I think the first major, like, splash of Bitcoin into the mainstream psyche was 2017, that cycle.
Right.
So we're approaching 10 years, or like 8 years since that cycle. And obviously we've gone down, gone back up, gone back down, and now on our way back up. And I just wonder, in between, you know, during that 8-year period, like how many touch points did most people have in marketing? They talk about touch points before conversion.
Not many, but I think we're now at the stage where you'd be hard pressed to find some American who's not aware of it. I mean, people who, you know, in my circles who thought I was nuts, you know, years ago, are all asking me about it. I mean, it's just hard not to be aware of it. I mean, they're talking about it on CNBC, you know, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so it is in the conversation now. It's well within the Overton window. It doesn't mean everyone's adopted it, but I think the awareness is clearly there. I mean, 100,000 really, that was a big milestone. It was a big, big deal. And, you know, and I think some of the skeptics are going to get tired of being wrong. You know, it's a bubble that's going to burst. Well, you know, it's had big drawdowns. Yeah, it has. But I mean, there's never been a bubble that's burst 4 times and keeps coming back.
You know what I mean? That's the reason I brought that. I was like, I wonder, on the meme, mimetic, cultural, sociological side of it, like, is there a Bitcoin brand touch point threshold that we're approaching that people just simply can't deny?
There's gotta be. Yeah. I mean, I do know among the younger people, you know, like I've got kids in their 20s, where they're all aware of it, and a lot of them are stacking it. I mean, I'm kind of my kids' friends, I'm impressed. I mean, you know, the boomers are, you know, a mixed bag, and a lot of them are just ignoring it. But young people, you know, they're interested, they get it. They get the problem that it solves. They're seeing, you know, the inflation. They're seeing the housing market. They can't buy a house. You know, they're wondering how the hell this whole mess is going to get resolved. And then once they start to study this, they're like, oh my goodness, this is it. As I've always said, it's your generation that's going to be the hero generation. You know, you and Jack and all the other people are doing this stuff. I mean, that's, you know, and it may get really messy here in the next 10 or 15 years, but you know, you guys are going to establish the new system, and Bitcoiners are going to politically establish the new system, because frankly, let's face it, the people who end up running the political system often are the people who have a lot of money, because they got the time and the ability and the support to, you know, to get involved in politics and make decisions. And so, you know, when Bitcoiners in general become fabulously rich, which I believe will happen in the next 5 or 10 years, you know, we're going to say, hey, you know what? Let's try and make this place a better place. Let's, you know, let's get sound money people in government. Let's balance the budget. Let's have term limits. Let's, you know, let's run this thing the way it should be run. And, you know, let's reform all these areas, and, you know, we'll have one hell of a renaissance. And then, you know, your hero generation you'll live out, you know, the next first turning. It'll be just a fabulous time. We'll have all kinds of AI and robotics, and, you know, living standards will be great. I mean, I've often said, it's amazing to me that we don't live better than we do, given all the technical innovations we've had since the 70s. Right. I mean, you know, we've had this enormous, I mean, you know, PCs, the internet, all of this stuff. It's just, it's groundbreaking what we can do. And yet, you know, most people are still struggling to put food on the table. And I'm like, huh? Where did all that productivity go? You know, and the answer is it went into the pockets of billionaires. You know, I mean, that's the broad answer, but it's accurate, because 1% of the country owns 92% of the wealth. So it didn't get evenly distributed around the way it would have if the money had been fair.
Yeah.
So
fix the money, fix the world, right?
Fix the money, fix the world. Thank you for that phrase. I always try and credit you with it. Somebody the other day on Twitter said, hey, Lepard said that first. No, I didn't. I took it from Marty.
I probably took it from somebody else. It's just,
well, who knows? Yeah, we all got it. Yeah. You know what it was from? Most people probably won't remember this reference. You remember show? Fix the,
Save the cheerleaders. World.
That's the whole concept. That's where it came from, I think.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Play on that. Like it's,
just a takeoff on that.
And that's what I hope anybody who's new to Bitcoin. And you mentioned Jack, and I was with, Jack was in Costa Rica, and we were hanging out, and I did his Money Matters podcast, and I think he's doing something really special, not only at Strike, but with this Money Matters podcast. And we were talking about it, and it's all new users to Bitcoin.
How fabulous.
Yeah, they have a live chat, and it is, people are asking the right questions, and I think he's a perfect individual.
Yeah, he's such a great spokesman for Bitcoin. I mean, you are too. And there's so many people in your generation who are just doing such a great job. It's cool to be the old guy kind of watching it and just, you know, cheering you guys on.
That's fun. it's fun to be on this ride with everybody. Yeah. You, Jack.
Yeah, it is a fun ride. I mean, I had dinner with Jeff Booth in the Middle East, and he said, so you know the cool thing about Bitcoin is that everybody's working for me. I mean, Michael Saylor's working for me. You're working for me. Marty Bent's working for me. You know, we all kind of contribute to the network and helping this thing grow and become better. We all work for each other. It's really a beautiful thing.
Yeah, it is. And I think, I hope more people are starting to get it. And I think the younger generation is, especially is like, you know, I think Jack's, the phrase that he's been running with, like, why would I work for money that somebody can print is.
Yeah. Really, I love that phrase. That was great. That was great phraseology. Yeah. I love
really landing with the younger generation. I think they're looking at it. That actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah. Right. Now that you mention it. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's all good. I mean, we are winning. I mean, maybe we'll be like Trump. We'll have so much winning. We just can't stand it anymore. We'll have to see.
Yeah, we'll have to start losing to feel something.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, we shouldn't get too cocky because there will be bumps along the road. And the other side does have some weapons, and I've watched them for 40 years. They play rough. And it wouldn't be beyond them to do some things that throw sand in our eyes. They already have. I mean, choke point, but there'll be others.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely don't get complacent. But where can anybody is so interested?
Well, so of course I'm on Twitter and X. It's just my name, Lawrence Lepard. I make a lot of noise. I scream at the central banks. That's, you know, old man yells at central banks. That's me. I have a website, EMA2.com. I write macro letters with my partner, David Foley, who runs the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund with James Lavish. They're raising money right now, if anyone's interested in that. It's a great fund. They're doing some really smart stuff. Obviously I've written this book, which is available for pre-sale on Twitter. I'm not on Twitter, on Amazon. It's, you can buy the Kindle version of it. They won't let me pre-sell the hard copy in paperback. And as we talked about before the call or before this started, my hard date is February 14th. I will definitely beat that. I hope to beat that by a lot. I mean, maybe like a late January date, maybe a Feb 1 kind of date. We'll see. It's in the layout right now, and I'm a perfectionist. I want to get it perfect. And so, and we're not perfect yet. So every day we try and make it a little bit better. And when it gets fully laid out, it'll launch. So,
yeah, Logan, pull it up on the screen so people can see it.
Yeah, oh, that'd be great if you could. Yeah, obviously, I mean, it's $10 for a Kindle version. If you can support it, great. I mean, they have all kinds of algorithms. The more, you know, we've sold a bunch of them, but the more we can sell, the better off we'll be in terms of getting it to spread wide and getting more promotion out of Amazon. Before I announce the book, I will announce that it's about to be released, so you can go back and cancel your Kindle order if you want and buy the hard copy or the paperback instead. So when I've released it or when I'm about to release it, I will say so on Twitter. So any help you can give me, I appreciate
Amazon
it.
Amazon makes it really easy. I just did the one click buy, and it was
very
easy. Yeah. Go check it out.
It's $10. It's $9.99. Yeah. So
the big print on Amazon. Great SEO. If you search the big print on Google, it is the first to come up.
Oh, is it? Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. So people, when I originally put it up, people say, "Yeah, I'm searching for the big print Lepard," and I get all these pictures of leopard prints. Right. And people on Amazon who are selling, you know, fabric with leopard prints on it. I was kind of like, well, yeah, OK, I guess that's it. Makes sense. I figure you misspelled, you know, leopard and you're looking for print.
Yeah. The big print. Search it on Google. We're going to link to it in the show notes. Larry, the legend, Lepard, everybody.
Oh, stop. 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 Thanks, Marty. You know, I got my start with you way back when, and I always remember that. And I deeply appreciate it and all your support and help and the slogan, everything. So you're a good guy and a good friend. And
well,
it's all making a difference.
The feeling is mutual, and I have a story for you after we finish recording here. Yeah. Peace and love, freaks. Okay.